This is WMNF Tampa. Time for Talking Animals.
It walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and this is a recorded version of Talking Animals, once again produced remotely at the corporate headquarters in Jupiter Farms, Florida. Today, I will feature two interviews I recorded in recent days. The first, which I'll air in just a moment, is with Joanne MacArthur, an extraordinary photojournalist I've spoken with a few times over the years, chiefly about her photography books, which have specialized in documenting the plight of animals in various settings across the world. She has created a forthcoming book, Hidden: Animals in the Anthropocene, that through the contributions of some 30 international photographers, examines our relationship with the so-called invisible or hidden animals in our lives, which, as MacArthur explains here, means the animals we eat, we wear, we use in research and for entertainment, and those we sacrifice in the name of tradition and religion. MacArthur and I discussed various aspects of Hidden, including the book's concept, how she assembled a team of photographers from throughout the globe, the crowdfunding campaign still underway until June 7th that's financing the publishing and distribution of the book, that Joaquin Phoenix has signed on to write the foreword, and how MacArthur, as someone who has dedicated herself to photographing animals in often disturbing, sometimes horrific circumstances, seeks balance in her life, photographically and otherwise. We'll hear that interview with Joanne MacArthur in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the program, I'll air another interview I recorded recently, this one with Glenn Hatchell, former programmer here at WMNF and the occasional guest host of Talking Animals, who is the behavior manager at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, where several years ago he started conducting playgroups for the dogs awaiting adoption at the shelter. We'll talk about how those playgroups work, the virtues of playgroups for the dogs, how COVID-19 has affected running the playgroups, and more. We'll hear that interview with Glenn Hatchell later in the program. Right now, in an interview recorded last Thursday about the forthcoming animal photojournalism book, Hidden, this is Joanne MacArthur on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us again on the show, Joanne.
It's such a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So, you know, of course, we're here chiefly to discuss this forthcoming book called Hidden, and we will indeed dive into that in some detail in a moment or two. But in preparing for this conversation, we've spoken a few times on the show, and I've heard you speak at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest, I guess about 5 years ago. And I got to thinking, you're a top-notch photographer who's specialized for years in documenting the plights of animals or various kind of awful circumstances that animals often find themselves in, and we'll get into some specifics, I guess, examples when we talk more about Hidden. But I started wondering, what other kinds of photographs do you take that may serve as a counterpoint to shooting the upsetting images that often figure into your work?
Hey, that's such a great question and an interesting way to start this conversation. Thanks.
Yeah.
The counterpoints are important to the work that the team and I do. I say the team because last time we spoke, it was still me as We Animals, but now I'm a team. It's an NGO called We Animals Media, and so you'll hear me refer to the team and I. And it really is important to tell the stories of hope and sanctuary and change and progress, because those affect people incredibly as well. I don't have the key to unlocking everyone's hearts. I wish I did. I wish I had that key to unlock their hearts on animal stories and compassion for animals, because the world would be a much better place. But I don't. And so what I do and what we do is to be very strategic about the stories we tell and how we tell them. We do undercover work that shows the most awful situations that animals are in because of us, but we also show the animal warriors, and we show the science, and we show the veterinary care and the sanctuary and the laws that are changing. And the main way we do that is through our project called Unbound. And Unbound is about women on the front lines of animal advocacy worldwide. So that's really exciting, and we have a nice following on that as well. And it inspires people. It's important to, on the one hand, show the reality of how animals live and die at our hands, but also to inspire people of what they can do. I don't want our work to paralyze people, and that's why we have to explain and talk and write well and encourage and show the path forward.
So I guess in addition to Unbound, and that makes perfect sense, I guess what got me on this path was just sort of thinking about you kind of, I guess, more personally. Like, in other words, you know, activists often discuss at conferences and other gatherings ways to stave off burnout, or worse than burnout even, from just too much work or sort of relentless work in dire circumstances. So I guess what I was kind of curious about is, when not on an assignment or working on a book or a specific project, do you shoot differently, entirely different kinds of photos as a remedy or a tonic of sorts for yourself? In other words, what kinds of self-care, photographically or otherwise, do you practice?
You know, Duncan, I can't say that I have a lot of that.
Okay.
No, I have other kinds of self-care, and it's not usually with the camera. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of solitude, and that's why quarantine right now in the pandemic is working for me quite nicely.
Yeah.
It's like a forced break for me.
Sure.
And but I certainly love a lot of solitude, be it, you know, in the garden or reading or writing. All sorts of ways to have nice quiet time. And certainly when I do get to do those nice photo shoots of Unbound and Sanctuary, it is certainly a balm, and I love doing that. I also like doing humanitarian shoots, which I used to do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's just once in a while. I do hope to be working with an organization called Project Smile this year. That's in the works. It was put on hold because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But they fix cleft palates worldwide, and it's all volunteer surgeons and nurses, and they do absolutely incredible work. So that's something that that brings me great joy.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's great. But otherwise, it sounds like you're busy, and it's a full dance card, and there's not really much room to take a moment and just do Joanne MacArthur stuff for Joanne MacArthur.
That's correct. It's probably why I don't have a boyfriend either.
I see. Okay. Well, we're finding out that's why I did want to start an interview like this, because I thought, well, let's, you know, we've talked enough times where we start right in with whatever the book or project is. Well, let's come from a different angle and see. I think it's already paid off in some interesting ways. So,
yeah.
So for folks, just,
so people are always curious about my personal life too. They want to know like how I cope, and they want to know like who is this girl? Like, she doesn't have kids. She doesn't seem to be married. It's like, well, yeah, and I chose that life, and I actually love my life, and I'm full of gratitude for all the daily things, the small things and the big things.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you know, a partner will come into my life soon that has the kind of enthusiasm for all these things that I do. And,
Well,
certainly open to it.
For sure. And again, up to this point at least, that life that you've been leading is the one that worked for you really, really well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Joanne MacArthur, photographer, co-editor, and creator of Hidden Animals, Hidden Animals in the Anthropocene, a book featuring the work of multiple photographers and documenting our relationship with non-human animals. This interview was recorded Thursday. So on the other hand, I suppose one way to help with some of those feelings is that it seems like there's more and more collaboration in some of your projects. The new book certainly seems very much more, as you've noted already, a team effort as opposed to a kind of more solo or just a couple photographers. So let's hit some basics about Hidden, starting with what exactly is Hidden. Let's just start really right at the most remedial level here.
Let's start there.
Okay.
Okay. There's been quite a rise in animal photojournalism. Traditionally, it's been about wildlife photography and then conservation photography, you know, beautiful portraits of charismatic animals. And then came a lot of gritty undercover work to expose animal cruelty. But in the last decade, we've seen a lot of really talented photographers take on this challenging subject matter, and they're producing really engaging work. And so I wanted to take a lot of this work that I've been looking at and even mentoring in some cases, and put it somewhere historic, put it somewhere valuable, somewhere beyond social media, somewhere beyond the news. And the news is just so incredibly fast. We only read the headlines at this point. So, you know, that's why photographers make books, is because we want to give something a home, and especially with important subject matter, like this. And so, yeah, this is the, I'm the creator, but the co-editor as well. We have about 30 contributors worldwide of the best animal photojournalism in the world, focusing specifically on hidden animals. So not so much the wildlife that we see in images all the time, National Geographic, etc. It's the animals we wear and we eat, animals who are experimented on and used in entertainment and religion and work and this kind of thing.
So on something like this, then, for you, did the concept or premise come first, or was it also, hey, I really want to do something that taps in and incorporates the work of so many great colleagues around the globe whose work I admire, or was it sort of almost like a simultaneous merging of both objectives?
I love your questions. Well, I'll go back a little bit and say that the book was inspired by a photo book called Inferno, and that was made by war photographer James Noctway. And this is an absolute tome, an indictment of decades of genocide and civil war and the things that we have done to each other. And he's like, look at this. You know, he's going to make a really bold statement with a really massive book. And when I saw that, I thought, I want to do this for animals someday. And my first book is similar, but not like that. And it was, you know, it was like step one in this massive thing that I always aimed to do. And I think I got off topic there. I think I just lost my train of thought.
Yeah, well, so what I asked just a moment before was the premise or the concept for you come first, or is like, hey, there's, look at all these amazing photographers out there that I know and have become friends with or colleagues with or whatever. Let's do the next thing with them and bring their work into this. But I was just curious, like, did that come first? Did the concept sort of inspired by Inferno come first? Or was it really almost simultaneously they kind of came together and like, here it is, boom, it's hidden. This is the next thing.
Yeah, there's no straight line with this.
Yeah.
In an effort to promote animal photojournalism, a few years ago, the team and I started the photographer series within We Animals. And so we would interview animal photojournalists and publish their work to help give them a platform and show the world and continue to legitimize animal photojournalism. Because still, you know, like that seems quite fringy and quite unimportant. That's something that animal activists have always been up against. And so I guess it's been a long, slow merge of ideas and strategy.
Yeah. And in terms of assembling the team of photographers that did contribute to Hidden, is it kind of a matter of rounding up the best photographers or work people whose work you really admire, or other criteria come to play, like geography, like where they live or where they're based, and like, well, okay, well, this could represent this and this because so and so lives here, or were there those kind of logistics that figured into it as well?
These are such good questions. I'm not just flattering you, I'm actually really enjoying this. Great question, because we are considering all of those things. There are some people who I know are producing excellent work. Unfortunately, a lot of those people are concentrated in Europe. And so we have a large amount of work from Europe. We have barely any representation from South America, which is really bothering me. So we continue to do research on this part of the world. Same with Africa. We have a lot of work from Asia, and so it is unfortunately geographically concentrated. Same with the photographers themselves. Also, it's a fairly gendered book. Like, a lot of the people who were producing the best work are men from Europe, which really bugs me.
Isn't that interesting?
We continue to diversify geographically and gender and race, because those things are important.
That's so interesting, because I mean, just, I don't want to go on a tangent myself either, but it's just interesting because I think anybody that knows much about the animal welfare world would say it's predominantly female. So it's just interesting that that's kind of flipped on its side when it comes to photographers doing this kind of work.
Yeah, I will say that it's the photo world that is definitely male dominated,
yeah,
and
yeah,
always has been. So I think that's why we're seeing that. It's and though there are a lot of women investigators, I think maybe it's the men who have, like, taken additional steps to upgrade gear and to practice more and to, you know, to become photographers.
Yeah.
The photo world probably is, you know, traditionally it has been like 80% men, and that's changing very, very quickly. I'm sure it's not that percentage anymore.
Yeah. So when you realized there were some of these gaps, South America, et cetera, did you say, okay, well, maybe I or someone else that's already involved with the project should go and do some shooting there just to sort of better represent those regions?
We did consider that, but it's not like we had a budget to send people on assignment. So, and that's a big budget thing. That's not small. So, you know, we're still in the editing phase and we're still in the collecting phase, even though we figured we would have wrapped that up like a half a year ago.
Yeah.
But we're still there. And it's also a matter of subject matter. Like, we saw that we were quite deficient in images of fishing, the fishing industry, and sea life. And so we're literally like finding images on the internet with no trace of where they came from and using reverse imaging software to try and find images. And there are a couple of images that we have no idea who the photographers are, and they absolutely must be in the book. Like, we cannot publish this book without these images. And after like weeks of trying, we still can't figure out, we can't get a response from like the South Korean publication that it came from and all this. So, to be continued on that.
Yeah. So all kinds of interesting challenges that when doing a book like this that you probably could not have anticipated when you began. But
we launched some really good news about the book today, though. Did you see?
I guess I didn't, because I don't know what you're referring to. So, yes,
okay.
Let's hear it.
It's big. I wrote to Joaquin Phoenix a couple of weeks ago to introduce him to the project and see if he would write for it. And he proudly said he would love to write. Yes, he would love to write the foreword.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
I know. It's just such an honor to have him.
Yeah.
You know, believing in the book and contributing to it.
Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations. That's really great. And he just seems so amazing in that way. And obviously has great taste to sort of say, yeah, this sounds like right up my alley. Sign me up. So good.
Yeah.
I
think it's the first foreword he's written. I'll have to ask him that.
Wow. Very cool.
But it's wonderful that he would contribute his time and his name.
For sure,
to this book.
That's great. So what would you say, Joe, is the, say, guiding principle of the book? I mean, what are some of the key themes? I mean, you've already noted, obviously, that hidden and rattled off some of the fields of those animals consist of, but are there broader themes in terms of the way the photos are coming together? And I know that it sounds like they're still coming together. But to create other themes or sub-themes that you'd like to tell me about?
The book has a flow, a designated flow from... Mm-hmm. One theme to the next.
Yeah.
That's all being very carefully curated
by
my co-editor. His name is Keith Wilson. So he's a photography journalist, and he has published many books, and he's got an incredible eye. Super, super lucky to have him on the team. And we also are working with a National Geographic designer, and he was also with the Washington Post. His name is David Griffin.
Yeah.
So we have like really, really, really strong design and graphic team there. So it's all going to flow. I don't know what else to tell you, but I think the book is going to be I know that the book is going to be very sparse with image with writing,
mm-hmm.
because we just want big, bold images. We want we want images to lead and to speak for themselves, which they certainly do. And image-driven for sure.
And how many images? No, obviously, again, it's still kind of being sorted out. But what's your best guess as to how many images the book will present in total?
My guess is about 250 images.
Wow.
The book will be a little over 300 pages, maybe up to 316 pages. It's going to be a 5-pound book with the hardcover and the quality of the paper, and so heavy in actual weight and thematically, of course.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to make a book that had a happy ending. We didn't want, because there's no happy ending right now for animals. I mean, certainly there are a lot of progress being made with like plant-based initiatives and all sorts of things, but like we just want this book to really hit you, and we don't want, like with We Animals, the last chapter is called Mercy, and it was images of like hope and change and things like that, but we really just wanted a creative book that is an indictment look at what we are doing. Look at what needs to change, and let that settle with people. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable book. It's an upsetting book. But these are stories of animals who suffer by the billions at our hands, and it's completely unnecessary. And I really want people to see what that looks like. As you know, being is one part of the puzzle when it comes to creating meaningful change in the world.
Sure. It's unusual, I guess, from some people's standpoint, to be discussing photography on a radio show. But we've been doing it for a number of years, and so I don't see any reason to stop now. So even though it sounds like there's going to be upward of 250 images in the book, can you maybe try, if it's not too unreasonable, to describe, let's say, three or four of the photos in Hidden that you think of as either highly powerful images or particularly representative of the book's objective, like sort of visual ambassadors of the book, if you will. And I know that's a tall task for so few out of so many, but there probably are some, whether there may or may not be one or more that you've taken, I hope so. But just any photos that you know are going to be in the book that you just think, well, I would kind of want to alert somebody to be on the lookout for this, or this is, I think, particularly in line with what Hidden is all about. So anything like that?
Yeah, there are a lot of standout images. The book, yes, it's about animals, but it's about the confines. You know, it's about what we have created and where we have put them.
Yeah.
And so some of the images just show exactly how outlandish our behavior is. One of the standout images for me is by a photographer named Etor Garmendia from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's shot from the back. It's at a circus, and there's a brown bear or grizzly bear, and he's sitting down, and there are children on either side of him.
Mm.
And it's a pose as though it were a family pose, like, yeah, you can tell on the other side is a family member taking a picture of all of them together.
Yeah.
But it's lit the way a circus is lit. It's just outlandishly terrible. And I think it's such a strong image because it exposes our really messed up relationship with animals and what shouldn't be, but it's not a gory image.
No, in fact, I was lucky enough, I think, to see that one. And it's not only not gory, what's striking about it, and this is, I think, what you're sort of touching on here, is that it's so kind of matter of fact. Like,
it's kind of sweet.
Yeah.
It's kind of like they're hugging a teddy bear.
Right. And yet it's a bear. It's a full-grown big bear, and one false move, and not to mention how a bear gets to the point where it can pose for that kind of photo. But anyway, yeah.
No,
very powerful. Okay,
like you said, never mind how a bear even gets to a place where he can pose for a picture.
Right.
That's exactly the kind of question that I want people,
sure,
to ask when they're,
yeah,
looking at these images. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
And then conversely, there's an image that I shot at a Turkish slaughterhouse just last year, and there are cows bleeding out, hanging from from one leg. They're all strung up along the wall, and then the next cow or bull is being led into the knock box. But like, they're walking into a room where they see this, like, they see everything that has happened and what is going to happen.
Yeah.
And the way, the dignity of the way the animal is moving into the knock box, and the way their head is hung, and like, you can accuse of anthropomorphism, but we know enough about animal behavior. Ethology is booming right now. It's a very exciting field to be in. We know that if they are standing in a certain way or reacting in a certain way, it's because they're happy or it's because they are scared.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that whole, like, you know, that anthropomorphism argument is, like, pretty well done.
Yeah.
For the most part. So, anyway, rant over. So, yeah, like, this bull is being led into the knock box, and you just can't help but have so much empathy for this animal who can see, you know, the other animals hanging right, like, 3 feet away,
yeah,
bleeding out. It's so unbelievably violent. And we don't think about the amount of violence when we think about, you know, when we sit down to absentmindedly eat a burger, for example.
Right, because again, those things are hidden, right? Yeah.
These things are hidden.
Yeah. So I know we're sort of running short on time, and I have a bunch of things I want to try to shoehorn in. So I'm going to.
Sure.
So we may come back to a couple other images. I know I asked you for three or four, and we only hit two, but that reminds me, especially your second selection of the image you shot, because I know many people find that graphic photos posted on, let's say, social media or elsewhere online, pictures from, say, slaughterhouses or medical testing facilities, what have you, can be so off-putting that some people find them counterproductive in a sense, because they're more, at that point, they're more upset about the picture than what's depicted in it. So if someone hearing the description of Hidden might be worried that some of the photos might be graphic, quite graphic in that same way, what would you say to them?
I would say a lot of things. On the level of the animal themselves, I mean, if they are living and dying this way because of our appetite, our consumer appetites, the least we could do is look and know what we are causing.
Yeah.
And what kind of suffering we're causing for others.
Okay.
And also, like, you know, not a lot of people are going to want to look at this book. I totally understand that. But a lot of people do want to look. A lot of people are curious.
Yeah.
And
well, and again, I should quickly hasten to say what you've already kind of alluded to, is that in no way, at least the sampling I've seen, or is it like a slew of gory photos by any measure. I mean, there are some difficult images in that way. If there's something from a slaughterhouse, there might be some blood or some gore. But the bear picture that you mentioned from at the very beginning is not the least bit that way, but it's powerful in its own way, nonetheless.
So. Yeah, images...
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
The more complex and thoughtful they are, the stronger they're going to be, and that's what we have in Hidden.
Yeah.
We had thousands of submissions. We put a call out to a certain number of photographers, but then we had submissions as well, and people still, the more they hear about it, the more they're submitting. And
not to mention there's fishing photos still being tracked down, so, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mentioned, I think, at one point, but I want to elaborate a little bit on this, because the book Hidden is being crowdfunded, and there's still a handful of days in the crowdfunding campaign. So maybe if you want to talk a little bit about how that works and...
Absolutely. Well, it has been so much fun because with the crowdfunding on Indiegogo, so people can just look up We Animals or Hidden and they'll find it, we had 61 days to raise $65,000. And this was all very carefully crafted, exactly what we needed and all this. And, you know, I figured we would get there, but I had no idea that we would reach our goal in 3.5 days.
Wow.
And it was just such a morale boost to know that the world... The world is a broad term, but like people took notice and said, yes, this is valuable, this is important, and I want to back this immediately. And so then what we did once we achieved our financial goal was create a secondary goal to sell 1,000 books. And we are probably at about 650 with about 20 days left. So now we really have to push it. And if we sell 1,000 books, we will have made sufficient profit to be able to give away and ship 100 books. For free to influential people. So that's the goal of our campaign now, and we're getting people to suggest the names of people that they want to have received the books, whether they be journalists or politicians or young influencers, chefs, you know, people who really need to see this book.
Yeah.
And that's the big push now. It's really exciting.
Right. So if I'm not mistaken, the crowdfunding thing still runs another few days through June 7th, I want to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
What we've decided to do is have the book purchasing there. It's called On Demand. And so once June 7th is done, hopefully we'll have met our 1,000 book goal, but people can still go to Indiegogo and purchase the book there. It's just going to make things a lot easy for us in the coming months.
Right.
The book does go to print in Italy on September 7th, and the book will be available by the end of the year.
That's great. So for people who wanted to either so they would go to the crowdfunding source if they wanted to still get in on that before that closes on June 7th, and or after that if they still wanted to just pre-order a book. Do I have that part right, the second part right?
Yeah, exactly. It's
okay.
Pre-ordering, which helps us produce the book. And so they would just go to Indiegogo.com and type in either We Animals or Hidden Animals in the Anthropocene. We talked about that word, Anthropocene, earlier, Duncan, before the show started.
Yeah.
And I do want to tell a little story about that.
Please do,
For me, the working title of the book was always Animals in the Anthropocene. And everyone said, like, unanimously, there's no way that can be your title. Like, it's way too long, and nobody knows what that word is. And so I had, you know, resigned to not having my beautiful title as the title. And I understood that. But it was actually David Griffin, our designer, when we were riffing on shorter titles, he said, well, Animals in the Anthropocene can be the subtitle. And we're like, oh, yeah, great.
Okay.
And so we did settle on Hidden. And I like how it also flows. It's Hidden: animals in the Anthropocene, but it's also hidden animals in the Anthropocene.
Right. Yeah. In fact, earlier I think I sort of mispronounced it that very way, like the punctuation didn't stop me. So.
So the book is called Hidden, and the Anthropocene is the proposed name for the current geologic epoch, and so that, you know, anthro is human, is man, and basically this is an epoch where we are a geologic force. We are changing nature. We are affecting everything and everyone on the planet.
Well, that makes perfect sense, and that title has, between the title and the subtitle, it's got everything. Right.
Thanks, man. I'm so proud of it.
Yeah. So, all right. So, anyway, I promise you we'd wrap up just about now. But let me ask you this. So, as we just covered, the book isn't published yet, but will be, and then it'll be available by the end of the year for all those who did crowdfunding or pre-ordered it or however they chose to get it. But when you look down the road a bit for that period when the book is out and about and people can hold it in their hands and page through it, what do you hope for in terms of results? What will success look like to you at that point?
Conversations,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Big public conversations,
okay.
And quiet monologues, you know, between me, myself, and I. I have seen over the last 15 years my work and the work of others who are covering these hidden animals change lives and make people, you know, confront and ask themselves big questions. And that is what I can hope for. Our work in a broader sense with We Animals Media, contributes to campaigns and it helps shape policy. So we have these broader objectives as well. But yeah, as we do in media, it's mainly about starting a conversation.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's probably the perfect point at which to leave our conversation. So
I have broader, like personally, I have broader goals. You know, I would love to see an absolute end to all animal exploitation. But
I like your ambition. That's great.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. No. Well, that's good to have big ambitions and dreams. And in the meantime, the conversations can take place until the bigger thing can be within reach. So that's
exactly
fair enough. Yeah. So we've been speaking with Joanne MacArthur again. The new book, the forthcoming book, I guess, really more accurately, is Hidden Animals in the Anthropocene. Again, you can go find out more about at weanimals.org or to really pursue the book or be in on the last few days of the crowdfunding campaign Indiegogo and just search for either We Animals or Hidden Animals in the Anthropocene. You can jump in on that or just simply pre-order the book that way. And Joanne, thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals, and I can't wait to check out the book myself when the time comes.
Thanks, Duncan, and I'm already looking forward to our next conversation.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, take care. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye. In a moment, I'll play back my conversation with Glenn Hatchell, Behavior Manager at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, discussing various aspects of dog playgroups, including the impact of COVID-19. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner. This is a portion of a piece by Mike Birbiglia called I'm a Bear in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
This is the first time I remember sleepwalking. I always had dreams about wild animals when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I had this recurring dream for years that there was a bear walking in the front door of my house, literally opening the front door, which is the scariest part when you think about it. A bear with opposable thumbs. Because if a bear can open a door, the sky's the limit. I don't have a plan for that one. My plan was the door. In the dream, I would hide in the kitchen cupboard with my sister Patty, and it's pitch black, and I'm scared to death, and I open up the door crack to let in some light. I look next to me, and Patty is gone, and she's been replaced by the bear. And it doesn't kill me, but it gives me kind of a coy Jack Nicholson-y look, like, will I kill you? And that's when I wake up. I had that dream for years, and then eventually I attempted to face this lifelong fear. Patty and I went to Alaska. We went to this place called Katmai National Park, which is one of these places that has so many bears that when you arrive, they take you to what's called bear orientation, and they teach you. And it seems counterintuitive, but if you ever see a bear walking towards you, you're actually supposed to clap and make the bear aware of your presence. Like, I'm right here, bear! I'm right here! I'm Mike and you're a bear and we're okay with each other. And when they told me this, I was like, oh, I'm going to be murdered by a bear, because that seems like basting yourself in barbecue sauce. You know, it's like, I'm right here, bear, I'm right here, and I taste fantastic. I've applied condiments so that I'll be less bland.
That was Mike Birbiglia with part of a piece called I'm a Bear, taken from his album Sleepwalk With Me. Now it's time to hear my conversation with Glenn Hatchell, Behavior Manager of the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, about the dog playgroups he's been conducting there for a number of years. Recorded Thursday, this is Glenn Hatchell on Talking Animals on WMNF. So let's welcome back to Talking Animals, the occasional host, by the way, of Talking Animals, Glenn Hatchell. How's it going, Glenn? Thanks for joining us.
Good, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks. Of course. So we've discussed playgroups on the show previously a few times, but before we get into the impact of COVID-19 on this particular realm, let's address playgroups more generally. Let's start at the very beginning. What are they exactly?
So playgroups with dogs are, it's an enrichment activity, which is an activity that helps dogs be less bored in the shelter and kind of decide, hey, this is a pretty great camp we're at until we find our new home. And in the morning, we do playgroups in the morning at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. And for the dogs that are not on a medical restriction, we will try to get them out in a yard off leash with other dogs. And that allows them to interact with other dogs, be off leash, and basically exhibit dog behaviors, you know, natural species specific behaviors, which is actually one of the five freedoms of animal care. So it fits within the five freedoms of animal care, but also it makes them excited to be in that environment because it's a fun place for them. Now, of course, not all dogs are social with other dogs, and that's part of what we do from the behavior aspect is match dogs together that gives them the most positive experience for the time that they're with us in our care.
Wow. All right. Well, somehow you've spurred about 27 questions just in that one response. So first of all, when did the playgroup start at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay?
I started them in 2012.
Okay. And I think I'd be remiss not asking this, even though it's slightly off topic at this point, but what are the other four freedoms of animal care? All right, we can come back to that. People can research that on their own. What the hell? Yeah, we only have a short time to talk. Yeah,
but briefly, it's access to medical care, it's access to food and water, it's a comfortable place to sleep, and it's fear it's being able to avoid fear and pain.
Okay, cool. So then, I guess the question is, how do you guys? It sounds like it's sort of a dating, like a dating matching up thing of like which dogs can play effectively and well and fruitfully, I guess, with others. So what is the criteria for determining, first of all, how many dogs in a given playgroup in a given morning?
Great question. Usually we average about 15 to 20 out during the day, not together, but out socializing with other dogs. So that could end up to be, well, with our current situation that has more to do with the fact that we have a new building being constructed on site.
Yeah.
We don't have the number of yards that we used to have, play yards, because they used to have interchanging yards. So I don't have the space nor the comfort of the ground because there's more rocks now versus dirt. So there's multitude of factors that right now, if we have five off-leash together in the yard, that's a big play group for us right now. So generally, I like to think of it more as kind of buddy play or what we're doing, or maybe there's, you know, three or four. But one of the changes that's happened slowly over the last couple of months and really has accelerated because of COVID is that I'm putting a lot more behavior focus on our dogs as soon as they come into the shelter. And that has enabled us over the last couple of months where we've actually had larger play groups than we have for the previous months. So it's just been interesting how things fluctuate, but it also depends on our, there's factors such as did they just get sick? You know, if we have a lot of dogs that are available for adoption that are already spay or neutered, then they can go right into the playgroup. But if we have to fix them, you know, before they're available for adoption, then that means they're on a medical restriction for 7 days before they can do playgroup while they heal. So, you know, there's factors, but generally in the mornings, we'll get somewhere around, like I said, 15 between in a social aspect and those that can't get with other dogs. This is I'm jumping ahead a little bit because I know where your questions are going to lead, because a lot of this is changing so much with, you know, what we're all dealing with right now.
Yeah.
Is we've had a great I've been referring to them as essential volunteers. And we've had a number of people over the last couple of months that have, because of the changes in all of our situations, their schedule all of a sudden has allowed them to come to the shelter on a much more regular basis. And so in the last couple of months, I've had a very consistent number of the same people coming in. And we've been able, usually almost every morning by 8 o'clock, I'm able to get all the dogs. They've already been all out for potty break in the morning, by 8 o'clock in the morning.
That's great.
And then somewhere between, you know, for the next couple of hours, then they're going to have that social interaction during playgroup. So there could be any mix there of, you know, interaction they're going to have there. And for those that aren't compatible, well, thinking about what you said there, I like to think of it more if you've ever gone through in corporate personality profiling, like the DISC profiles, and there's the GEM profiles, I think, and
okay.
There's the color profiles to where, you know, you're looking at the different balances of teams.
Yeah.
And I like to think of playgroups more like that, that I want a good solid player to be able to teach a dog that needs to learn and maybe a fearful dog. So the better the mix is, the more the dogs get to maybe learn different
experience.
Styles, so to speak.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the bottom line is I want it to be positive for them. I want those dogs to be able to be excited about the fact of, no, don't take me back yet. I want to go back into playgroup. That's bottom line, the most important thing about playgroups.
Yeah.
But it really is the gem. It's the center of all the behavior programs that I've been doing for the last 8 years.
So, Glenn, with that mix and with all these factors that you mentioned that kind of do... The dogs who participated, like the 15 or 20 dogs who participated in this morning's playgroups, will they be in tomorrow's playgroup, or will it be a slightly different mix, but some will be present from today that carry over to tomorrow, or how does that go from day to day?
There's a couple of factors that play into it. One, there were dogs this morning who will be fixed today.
Okay.
So they won't be eligible for tomorrow.
I got you.
There were some that would have gotten adopted today. So
okay.
Fortunately, they'll be sleeping on a bed in a bed or on a couch
yeah.
tonight.
Yeah.
And
congrats.
And then there will be new dogs that will be available to come into playgroup tomorrow.
Okay.
Generally, the good thing is there's generally a core group of dogs who we've had out two or three times and have gotten a good sense of how we can use them with other dogs and what will be good for them.
Yeah.
So. That's the, you know, I kind of think of it in, I think, baking. Is it sourdough bread? There's some kind of baking bit where you always want to take from the last meal and take it into the next meal. And it's almost, boy, what a bad analogy that was.
well.
But it really is. It's having that ability to take forward. But it also lets us be able to use helper dogs because
yeah.
we end up with so many dogs, especially right now. It just seems like we've really had a lot of scared and fearful dogs lately.
Yeah.
And the best thing for a scared and fearful dog is a helper dog.
So that brings me to this then, Glenn. Like, and I know we've talked about this, I'm sure, at least once or twice before. But is there a way to quantify or at least tangibly identify the benefits, changes in the dog's behavior or temperament when they've been in playgroups for a while relative to his or her adoption prospect?
Well, so anecdotally, I'll answer that anecdotally, and
okay.
I'll then talk about the science behind it.
Okay.
Or the science behind a different thing. There's a cortisone is I'm not medically trained. I can't remember if cortisone's a hormone or
yeah,
something.
I think
but cortisone
so.
Is released is based on stress levels. And while some say cortisone is not necessarily it's one of multiple measurements, but it's like the only one that can really be measured. And what is shown is that dogs that have gone into playgroup and had that kind of enrichment and such have had lower cortisone levels, and lower cortisone levels equate to less stress.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of kind of from the scientific aspect. Well, there are, and cortisone is used in a lot of different measurements and a lot of studies, but especially with stress, not just with
yeah.
playgroups, but I've seen a number of other studies where stress was a component and cortisone was what they measured.
Sure.
But anecdotally, I look at it from our length of stay,
mm-hmm.
Because there was a study that ASPCA did in 2012 of five shelters around the country, one being what is now the Hillsborough County Pet Resource Center. And they interviewed or surveyed about 1,500 adopters, and the number two factor on dogs was their presentation in the kennel. And the number three factor was what they did on an adoption visit and basically come up to them at a social aspect. And what we know from play groups is that that gets the dogs more comfortable in that environment. And because people take them to do fun things, when people come in, they show good behaviors, you know. So that's how I kind of tailor everything with playgroups, and all the things that we do at the Humane Society is, you know, towards being excited because people are going to bring good things.
Yeah. Let me let folks know real quick that we're speaking with Glenn Hatchell, who is a dog trainer, wearer of many hats in terms of dog expertise, including for the last 8 years or so, running the playgroups for the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. So, Glenn, we're just kind of nearing the end of our time here, but one of the things I wondered about is, because you talk with such great enthusiasm about the playgroups and the dogs you're working with and ones that come turn a corner, of course, et cetera. So just generally, though, what do you get? We're seeing what the dogs get out of the playgroups and how much they're better for adoption and fostering purposes. But what do you get out of leading these groups?
Oh, we don't have enough time left to talk about all that.
Okay.
Well, no, it's really, you know, I love learning, you know,
yeah.
And the amazing thing about working with dogs is that even though we've been doing it for 8 years, I'm just as excited to get up every morning to go up there and do it, because even though it's going through the same thing, when you see that animal, and I mean, it's the scared and fearful ones that really I love to work with, you know, and just being able to do things, and also I think do it over and over again and see that, you know, positive reinforcement work. You know, if
yeah.
we, you know, if they're scared and don't, they're so scared they don't want to eat cheese, let's give them liverwurst, you know?
Right.
And just watching those dogs do that change and then even carrying it forward, you know, then they go into a home and then they come to a group class. And, you know, it just,
yeah.
It's fun. And I think that's the thing I was telling somebody yesterday. I mean, that's part of it, because they were talking about surprise that I was still so hands-on. And, you know, like I said, the thing is, it's just so much fun.
Yeah. You're not taking this away from me, pal. I'm going to do this every morning. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you kind of touched on the fact that COVID-19, one virtue in a weird way, was that some volunteers had more time to dedicate to helping out at the shelter there. What other kind of impact did COVID-19 have on the playgroups themselves? Did you make some other alterations because of the restrictions, or was it mostly just kind of proceeding as you normally would?
Well, definitely some adjusting, and really that's become our MO here for the last 9 months, because we started a new shelter building,
yeah.
So I completely had to adjust everything because of relocation of the yards and changing of walk paths for the dogs and everything along that line, and
yeah.
Then, of course, beginning of this year, well, I mean, come then in the last couple of months, we've had COVID, so we had to adjust for that.
Sure.
And it's really more of, not that there were more people who could volunteer and such, but we ended up with almost a consistent core group over the last couple of months. So what that's allowed me to do is focus more on our dogs that are just coming in,
okay.
And our experienced volunteers who are there regularly. I can let them know, okay, Brutus can't go to playgroup today, but he really needs to have more than just a walk around the block.
Mm-hmm.
So how about taking him walking through the West Tampa neighborhood?
Nice.
So some of our dogs will get a walk through the neighborhood, for example.
Nice.
So we've done some of those kind of things, and
yeah.
Part of it is because I've got fewer people there, and I know more of where that dog is at that moment. Like I said, I focused down on the end. But, you know, interestingly, I think because of, since we had to pay so much attention, I really think from a behavior aspect, we've been able to really give a lot more focus to the dogs. And I just can't say enough about how amazing the Tampa Bay community has been, because I think I don't know that we've had any dog that's been available for adoption for more than 3 days.
Wow.
In the last 8 to 10 weeks. You know, it's
yeah.
just been amazing how the community, every morning, just about, there is somebody there before we are even open, already there in line.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, we can't do, you know, without the community coming and supporting the dogs, we can't do what we're doing. You know, so, I mean, that is the ultimate. If people aren't adopting the dogs and the cats
yeah.
and the rabbits. Oh, and speaking of that, so the other change now that we're starting to adjust again, or having to adjust now, because I can go ahead and plug this for those who are local and are thinking about going to the Humane Society, is that our hours now are consistent 7 days a week, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Wow.
We used to have different hours weekday and the weekends, but now it's 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. 7 days a week.
That's great to be able to just know that off the top of your head, not have to say, oh, wait, what about Saturdays or what happens on Wednesday or whatever. So, yeah.
Exactly. And one more plug, since we're talking, the dogs have been flying out, but all of a sudden, unfortunately, it's kitten season.
Right.
And so right now, I believe, and maybe even today, there was a kitten special started, so you can check out the Humane Society of Tampa Bay's website for all the information on special on adoption specials that may be going on, because obviously we're all living in a unique time right now that we've never experienced.
Right. No, there's, you know, say what you will about the pandemic, but it has spurred a tremendous number of adoptions locally, nationwide, and so let's hope that carries over for kitty season as well. So
yes.
So, Glenn, thanks so much for joining us again. This has been Glenn Hatchell. And, again, you can find out about the kitten special and all kinds of other information, including some of the stuff we've been talking about on HumaneSocietyTampa.org. Again, he's with the Humane Society Tampa Bay, and they're doing such great stuff. And pretty soon there'll be a whole other building available to do even more great stuff. So that's going to be cool and exciting. So, Glenn, thanks again for joining us again on Talking Animals. And one of these days soon, when things kind of get back to normal, we'll have you in hosting so the thing can be done properly.
That sounds good. Stay
All right.
safe.
All right, you too. Thanks, man. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're listening to Talking Animals. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Loroy with Radioactivity. Meanwhile, on this show at the moment, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. As a reminder, we do Name That Animal Tune differently these days. Rather than call if you know the tune, please email me at duncan@wmnf.org with your guess of the song title. Again, a Talking Animals t-shirt to the first person who emails duncan@wmnf.org and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. Delighted that we have just enough time to slide in an animal song. Here's Bishop Briggs with Wild Horses, not the Stone Song, on Talking Animals on WMNF.
You hold me down in the best way. No quarter from these chains that I slapped on my heart for a feeling. Why can't I let my demons lie? Keep screaming into the pillow. Cause your touch still gets me stupid high. Oh glory, I'm a believer. Oh glory, I'm a tribal. Wild horses, wild horses, wild horses, run faster, run faster, run faster. Wild horses. Keep on damning the devil, and you'll keep on saying it. it's alright. Oh glory, I'm a believer. Oh Lord, I'm holding tight. But wild horses, wild horses, wild horses, run faster, run faster, run faster. Wild horses, run faster, run faster, run faster. Wild horses, run faster, run faster, run faster.
That was Bishop Briggs with Wild Horses, suggested to me by Jeff Stewart, wonderful host of the Wednesday Morning Show here on WMNF. We've just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for Rob Lori. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond.